who are talking about reparations in a climate when DEI is a curse word. How about that?
We going to keep it moving on reparations regardless to what the new word is that you'd like to describe it. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you for all you do, and hope to see you tonight.
I will.
That's at the IMC.
Yes.
Okay. I don't remember that being mentioned, but...
It's at the Independent Media Center, downtown Urbana.
That's where CUPJ was sort of birthed, I guess.
Yes, we were.
Uh-huh. Okay, speaking of the piece about geriatric prisoners that you mentioned earlier, I'm glad you're working on that. Here's one of my favorite geriatric prisoners, prisoner of conscience, political prisoner, Mumia Jamal. Maybe every 2 weeks or so he's putting out a commentary. You go to prisonradio.org and look at some of the titles of the other prisoners who are contributing to this. I'm sure it's important for them, but this one's important for me. I haven't heard all of it yet, so I'll be listening closely. I'll do a rundown of what I got coming up. I'm going to get kind of nerdy on AI. Sister Carol also mentioned she's working on that with the part that says, why are utility ratepayers paying for big business to have their AI powered, actually. So, the bubble in AI has been discussed a lot. Is it just getting bigger and bigger? I'm going to leave the discourse. Oh, I should hide. Well, I'm doing the storyboard now, actually, I guess. One of my favorite commentaries on Israel, Palestine, and political rights in the U.S. is Marjorie Cohn. That's C-O-H-N. It's a variant spelling of C-O-H-E-N, and she shares the name with mentor of our current president. And Roy Cohn was on the phone with Trump 3 or 4 times a day through his one of his periods of swindling. He was a mob lawyer, too. Probably paved the way for a lot of relationships. And then... when he came down with AIDS, he was a loser, and Trump totally abandoned him. So, not a surprise.
Wars of the freedom of speech. The U.S. gets kudos all around the world for its heralded First Amendment rights, including the right to freedom of speech. Does the record suggest that? Let's examine it. Years ago, during the last months of the 60s, about 4 young brothers, including myself, went to the Spectrum, a huge arena in South Philly, to protest the appearance of Governor George Wallace of Alabama, who was there to give a speech in support of his presidential campaign. We viewed Wallace, an arch segregationist, as a racist, and we wanted our voices to be heard. We shouted Black Power in the arena and got rushed out by security guards and police. When we left, we were all beaten by plainclothes cops. All of us have scars on our bodies from injuries we sustained that night. How free was free speech if we paid for it in blood, scars, and injuries? Fast forward to today, to the fall of 2024, when students were awakened to the genocidal carnage against Gazans in Palestine for speaking and speaking out against Zionist violence against Palestinians. Many of these students were suspended or expelled from their schools. Some students had their job offers withdrawn. How free is free speech when students are expelled or their life careers are threatened? And let's look at this. Today, there were thousands and thousands of Latinos and Hispanics all across the country who were terrified of speaking their language, Spanish, in the streets of the United States for fear of being thrown into a car by men with masks and then thrown into a cell and then exported out of the country to God knows where. Does that sound like free speech to you? Free speech is a bourgeois promise that ignores more than it protects. And bourgeois promises, make it real, protect free speech with love, not fear. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Prison Radio.
Indeed. Well said. And trying to decide what order. I guess I'll get nerdy. I didn't mention, of course, Amy Goodman's commentary, and of course, it's Dateline Baleem. She's off to Amsterdam, I noticed, in her itinerary. I think I should read an announcement here. Programming at WEFT is brought to you in part by Live Action Games, right next door here to WEFT. They have a wide selection of classic and modern video games, consoles, controllers, books, and collectibles. Live Action Games covers it all. They're open Tuesday through Saturday at 111 North Market Street in downtown Champaign, right next door to WEFT. As I mentioned, new and gently used inventory arrives daily. For a list of in-stock items or live additional information, go to LAG or call. It's visit LAG217.com or call 217-359-4863. That's 359-GAME. Great Australian chap has that business next door. All right, Amy Goodman's commentary. Let's do that right now. And, I guess I'll play Marjorie Cohn first and then get nerdy with AI and AI investments and bubbles and shenanigans. There's a little commentary about Trump and the Epstein file release. It's worthy of hearing. It was recorded maybe on Wednesday, but still. So is Marjorie Taylor Greene expecting to be apologized to and called back in? Is that why she resigned? Or do they have something on her? One Nation under blackmail. I'm kind of inclined to think the latter, but who knows? I thought about starting a running series called Awful from the Oval. And depending on how you say it, it sounds more like awful or offal, which is another, I guess, Anglo-Saxon name for feces. Or is it guts? I forget. Anyway, after the two back-to-back Oval Office phenomenons with Mr. Bonesaw and then Mamdani, I don't know what to make of things. It's hard to deal with, isn't it? All right, I want to get material on that. I've storyboarded and going to let you know. Don't forget Radio Free Labor coming up with Gus. Hopefully Stephanie will be on board too to go through some of the things in the day. Province-wide general strike in one of the Canadian provinces? I don't know. Maybe they'll mention that. I've been watching CBC's National a little bit online and just to get a different perspective on some of the things going on. All right. Here's Amy Goodman.
COP30 in the Amazon and the hope of Indigenous leadership. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. Belém, Brazil. The Amazon rainforest, often described as the lungs of the planet, is teeming with life. Thousands of Amazonian land defenders, both indigenous people and their allies, have traveled to the tropical city of Belém, Brazil, the gateway to the Amazon, carrying their message that the rainforest is at a tipping point but can still be saved. Their focus is on COP30, the 30th Conference of Parties to the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, UNFCCC, the official body created after the 1992 Rio Earth Summit to negotiate and implement a global treaty to limit human-caused global warming. 33 years later, the negotiations stagger forward at far too slow a pace than what is needed to avert catastrophic climate disaster. That became apparent as the conference wrapped up its first week. Hundreds of activists arrived on several caravans and riverborne flotillas in advance of a major civil society march. On Friday night, an indigenous-led march arrived at the perimeter of the COP's Blue Zone, a secure area accessible only to those bearing official summit credentials. The group stormed security, kicking down a door. United Nations police contained the protest, but it was a marker of the level of frustration at the failure of the deliberations to deliver just and effective climate action. Alessandra Munduruku, president of the Pariri Indigenous Association, was a leader of the protest. In 2023, she was awarded the prestigious Goldman Environmental Prize for her leadership in organizing, forcing British mining giant Anglo-American to withdraw from indigenous lands, including those of her people.
It was very difficult for our people who had traveled for so long to get here, and the people wanted to be heard.
Alessandra said on the Democracy Now! NewsHour, speaking inside the COP.
We came in a large delegation, and we wanted to speak, and we wanted to be heard, but we were blocked. I have credentials to enter COP, but many of the Munduruku who are here do not. And so we decided that we needed to stop this COP. We needed people to stop and to listen to us. They needed to listen to us because we are the ones that are saying what the forest is demanding. We are the ones that are saying what the river is asking for.
Close to 190 nations sent delegations here to hammer out a roadmap to phase out fossil fuels. Noticeably absent is the United States. President Donald Trump refused to send an official delegation, a first for the U.S. Trump calls climate change a con job and has ordered the U.S. to withdraw from the Paris Climate Agreement. Jean Hsu of the Center for Biological Diversity responded to the U.S.'s absence at COP, saying on Democracy Now!,
people should celebrate the fact that that obstruction is not here and pass as fast as possible mechanisms like a fossil fuel phase-out roadmap where the U.S. is not here, but they could be bound by it later.
The U.S. is the historically largest greenhouse gas emitter on the planet. Now that urgent action is needed to reverse the damage already done, the U.S. backs out. When asked at COP30 if he thinks Trump might rejoin the talks, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres replied,
"Hope is the last thing that dies."
It will take more than hope to save the Amazon rainforest. Sonia Guajajara is Brazil's first ever minister of indigenous peoples.
Beyond forest, people need to understand that we have culture, we have people, and we have a diversity of people that protects the Amazon.
Minister Guajajara said on Democracy Now! During COP30.
It's important that the world know that it's not only forests and animals that live in the Amazon. There are people living there, people that are being attacked, assaulted. They're having their rights violated and that they need protection.
One important outcome Guajajara is working on at the COP30 negotiations is the recognition of the rights of indigenous people.
We are expecting the recognition of indigenous territories and the demarcation of these territories as a climate policy, one of the most efficient solutions to confront the climate crisis.
Demarcation is the first difficult step in Brazil to protect traditional indigenous territories from exploitation by extractive industries like logging, mining, and land clearing to make way for cattle ranching. Days after the COP30 protest, led by Alessandra Korab Munduruku, her territory and nine others were finally demarcated, a hard-won victory that took years of struggle. This year's UN Climate Summit has the greatest number of accredited indigenous people in attendance than ever before, nearing 1,000. Among the forces they're up against are over 1,600 fossil fuel industry lobbyists also in attendance. Who wins will determine the fate of the Amazon and of the planet itself. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan in Belém, Brazil.
Ah, glad she made the trip. Did a whole week of it. All right, I'm way behind, as usual. Marjorie Cohn. That's M-A-J-O-R-I-E. And Cohn is not is C-O-H-N, as I mentioned at the top. All of her articles are at her own personal website, but she runs down where she publishes that. But then again, I might excerpt that section because I'm running behind. Here, the conversation with another lawyer, and he really admired the craft of the lawsuit that's being discussed against this anti-Semitism bill that was passed in California. She resides in Southern California, emeritus professor at, I forget what, L.A. area institution.
Beginning January 1st of next year, teachers in California classrooms will have to look over their shoulders to avoid running afoul of an alarming new anti-Semitism law. On October 7th, despite widespread opposition from teachers' unions, civil rights groups, and education advocates, Governor Gavin Newsom signed AB 715. It amends the California Education Code to police what teachers can teach and what students can learn about Israel and Palestine. Under this law, teachers could be charged with unlawful discrimination and disciplined, and I quote, if they expose their students to ideas, information, and instructional materials that may be considered critical of the State of Israel and the philosophy of Zionism, close quote, according to a lawsuit filed on November 2nd by the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee. With us today to analyze this new law is Marjorie Cohn. She is Professor Emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law, Dean of the People's Academy of International Law, and former president of the National Lawyers Guild. She is a legal and political analyst who does media commentary and writes columns on Truthout and other outlets, and is a former host on Law and Disorder Radio. Her most recent book is Drones and Targeted Killing, Legal, Moral, and Geopolitical Issues. Marjorie wrote an article that was published earlier this month in Truthout titled, Lawsuit Charges That California Law Illegally Muzzles Students and Teachers on Palestine, close quote. Well, Marjorie Cohn, a warm welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Well, thanks for having me, Jim.
Marjorie, let's start off. We'll get to the plaintiffs later and in terms of who the individual plaintiffs are. They have some interesting stories. But California has a dominant Democratic majority in their state legislature. But who is behind this law and why did Governor Newsom sign it?
Well, that's a really good question, Jim. The Jewish Public Affairs Committee, or JPAC, was behind this bill, and they worked with the California Legislative Jewish Caucus to pass it. It went to a vote when it could have died in committee. One of the sponsors, California Senate President Pro Tem Mike McGuire, wants Israel lobby support when he runs for Congress in one of the newly drawn Proposition 50 districts, you know, the new districts that California just voted for. The diversity caucuses, African American Caucus, Asian Pacific Islander Caucus, and Latino Caucus, signed on as authors of the bill in hopes of getting ethnic studies funded, which did not happen. Governor Newsom signed the bill because he wants Israel lobby support when he runs for president. He's been tethered to the Israel lobby throughout his term as governor, and he was roasted on social media for acting clueless about APAC, American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, which is a very powerful pro-Zionist lobby in the U.S. and owns many people in Congress, I'm afraid. Members of the California state legislature are afraid that Assemblymember Jesse Gabriel, chair of the California Legislative Jewish Caucus, and California Senator Scott Weiner, they're afraid of them because they chair the budget committees and they are the face of the Israel lobby in the California state legislature. The short answer to your question, Jim, is the Israel lobby.
AB 715, the law we're talking about, is it says it's designed to punish anti-Semitism, but how does that bill define, in fact, anti-Semitism?
Although it's ostensibly aimed at preventing anti-Semitism in the classroom, AB 17 doesn't define anti-Semitism. Rather, it instructs school districts to follow Joe Biden's U.S. national strategy to combat anti-Semitism. And that national strategy adopts the definition of anti-Semitism in the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, or the IHRA. The IHRA lists several examples of attitudes and speech that it defines as anti-Semitic. And I'll just give you a few examples. Accusing Jewish citizens of being more loyal to Israel or to the alleged priorities of Jews worldwide than to the interest of their own nations. Denying the Jewish people their right to self-determination, that is, by claiming that the existence of the State of Israel is a racist endeavor. Applying double standards by requiring of Israel a behavior not expected or demanded of any other democratic nation, and I say democratic in quotes, because of course we know Israel is democratic only if you're Jewish. Drawing comparisons of contemporary Israeli policy to that of the Nazis. So those are some examples in this International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, IHRA. Both Biden's national security strategy and the IHRA conflate the criticism of Israel and Zionism with anti-Semitism. For example, they call it anti-Semitic to challenge Jewish people's right to a majority state in an area inhabited by an equal number of Palestinians. They require, quote, factually accurate, unquote, instruction, but they punish teachers professionally for making accurate statements, such as the fact that 750,000 Palestinians were forcibly expelled in 1948 during the creation of Israel in the Nakba. This conundrum places teachers in an untenable position.
Well, what are the constitutional provisions that the plaintiffs, and we will discuss those plaintiffs in a minute, what are the constitutional provisions that those plaintiffs are alleging are being violated by AB 715?
First, that it violates the First Amendment rights of teachers by being overbroad and viewpoint discriminatory, because it suggests that criticism of Israel and Zionism constitutes anti-Semitic discrimination. Second, that it violates the First Amendment right of students to receive information in the classroom. They'll be prevented from learning about different perspectives on Israel, Palestine, and the Middle East. And third, that it's unconstitutionally vague in violation of the Due Process Clause because it doesn't define the terms it purports to regulate. That opens the door to arbitrary and uneven enforcement. And thus, teachers can't know what they can or can't say, so they'll self-censor to avoid punishment.
Andrea Pritchett is the lead plaintiff in this lawsuit. Please tell us a bit about her and why she's so worried about AB 715.
First I want to say, Jim, that this lawsuit was filed in U.S. District Court for the Northern District of California on behalf of California public school teachers and parents of students who seek to teach and learn about Palestine, Israel, and the Middle East. And the defendants named in this lawsuit, Pritchett versus Newsom, are Newsom, Attorney General Rob Bonta, and Superintendent of Public Instruction Tony Thurmond. So the plaintiffs. First of all, Andrea Pritchett is a middle school history teacher at a public school in Berkeley, and all of this is in California, of course. She has many Palestinian students, and as part of a class project, they research and interview their parents about the events that led to their migration from Palestine. This entails discussion about settlements, colonization, and genocide. But there have already been two complaints against Pritchett, including when a student mentioned Israel and Palestine as examples of modern-day colonialism, and Pritchett responded that Israeli settlements in Palestine are an example of colonialism. Well, there was a long investigation and the complaints against her were dismissed. But once AB 715 goes into effect on January 1st, Pritchett will be reluctant to teach about Israel and Palestine. Palestinian citizens of Israel don't have equal rights as Jewish citizens, and Palestinians in the West Bank have almost no rights at all under Israeli occupation. The international consensus is that Israel is illegally occupying Palestine. In fact, the International Court of Justice has actually held that, and that is factually accurate. But it could also be deemed anti-Semitic under this new law, as illustrated by Pritchett's previous experiences fielding complaints for saying similar things. And in light of what happened to her in the absence of AB 715, Pritchett said, quote, "I have almost no doubt that I would be a target under the new law."
Well, another plaintiff is Jonah Olson. Tell us about Jonah Olson and what his concerns are.
Well, Jonah Olson is a Jewish non-Zionist middle school science teacher at a public school in Adelanto, and he distinguishes between Zionism and Judaism. He believes that Zionism is a political ideology premised on the notion that Jews are superior to non-Jews and that they have the right to be a majority in a land that was inhabited primarily by Palestinians for hundreds of years and to occupy Palestine in order to maintain that majority. Olson's students work on science projects, and one project was designed to provide food in war-torn areas after the students saw photographs of moldy food that was delivered to Palestinians in Gaza. Another student focused in a project on distilling water after seeing images of a Palestinian woman in Gaza being forced to distill her own water due to lack of access to clean water. Well, once AB 715 is in effect, Olson says he will be afraid to allow discussion of food preservation and water distillation in Palestine because it could be considered anti-Semitic by pro-Israel individuals.
Well, and then another plaintiff is Dunia, I hope I pronounced that right, Hassan. What's her background, and how does she think she's going to have to alter her assignments once AB 715 takes effect?
Dunia Hassan is a high school Spanish teacher at a public school in Santa Clara, and she was born to a Spanish mother and a Palestinian father. Her father came to Spain after being driven out of Haifa, Palestine, in 1948, when Israeli forces occupied his village and destroyed its homes and agriculture. She grew up hearing stories of her father's life in a refugee camp. After the October 2023 Hamas attack on Israel, her students began seeing horrific images of violence and destruction in Gaza and the West Bank. And a significant pro-Israel bias infiltrated her school district, according to this lawsuit. Hassan says that after AB 715 becomes effective, she would be hesitant to assign presentations called My Name, My Identity that she has assigned in the past.
Now, Marjorie Cohen, what are the plaintiffs in this lawsuit actually asking the court to do?
Well, before I answer that, Jim, I just want to add that this new law empowers anyone to anonymously file a complaint claiming that classroom content and instructional materials are critical of Israel and therefore anti-Semitic. And the new law provides for the appointment of an anti-Semitism prevention coordinator, whose job it is to review the curriculum and threaten school districts with fines and teacher dismissals for refusing to discontinue the dissemination of material considered, quote, factually inaccurate.
And the plaintiff in the lawsuit, they're asking the court to do what then?
They are asking the federal court for what is called declaratory relief. The plaintiffs want the federal court to declare that the AB 715 amendments to the California Education Code violate the teacher plaintiff's rights to due process under the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution because they are unconstitutionally vague. The lawsuit also seeks a declaration from the court that the amendments violate the teacher plaintiff's rights under the First Amendment because they are overbroad and viewpoint discriminatory. And finally, under declaratory relief, the lawsuit requests that the court issue a declaration that the amendments violate the student plaintiff's rights under the First Amendment because they are overbroad and viewpoint discriminatory. So that same they want that same declaration vis-a-vis the teacher plaintiffs and the teacher students. And then the lawsuit is also seeking an injunction to prevent the defendants from enforcing the AB 715 amendments.
I wonder, Marjorie, are any other states having similar laws or facing pressure and lobbying to have a similar law to the one we've been discussing today?
Jim, my understanding is that they are, and I can't tell you specifics right now, but I understand that this is not unique to California.
I think in the course of answering the questions, you may have already touched on this, but let's be clear. Why does the contention of these plaintiffs, and I gather your contention as well, that simply being critical of Zionism is not discriminatory towards the Jewish race or the Jewish religion?
That's true, Jim. This is censorship, bald-faced censorship. And for people who want to understand the difference between Judaism and Zionism, I would refer you to a collection called Reclaiming Judaism from Zionism, Stories of Personal Transformation. It's a group of essays from activists, writers, students, rabbis who have rejected Zionism but feel very close to their Judaism. I actually have an essay in this book. And one of the very interesting things about this collection, Reclaiming Judaism from Zionism, which is edited by Carolyn Karcher, is the introduction and the afterword that contain a very interesting and informative history of how Zionism developed and what it is. So I strongly urge the listeners to pick up that book because I think it would be very, very useful to them.
And that's Marjorie Cohen. I wanted to include at least that part about her participation in this anthology, Reclaiming Judaism from Zionism. Okay. Are we about halfway through? I'll mention again the opinions you hear are those of the speakers. Marjorie Cohen, again, is spelled C-O-H-N. And she's at Truth Out, and but all of her articles and a link to that book is at her own website, which is just Marjorie Cohn. And again, the spelling of Marjorie is not the typical one. It's M-A-J-O-R-I-E. Whenever I can find an interview with her, I like to get it on. That's true of Joel Bynum, and he also spoke with Brian Edwards Tekert about the deal. My news aggregator with Google had in 2 days in a row, had no reports on Gaza at all. Successfully removing it from the headlines, where his other peace plan is now dominating. I guess I'm going to try and skip over the section that I mentioned I would play from a colleague of Marjorie, David Dayan, who we'll hear talking about AI. This is going to get nerdy.
A quick review of the relevant history.
Thank you. Brian Cooper, welcome.
That was our Speaker of the House. I guess there is another this mechanism for getting the Epstein files on the table. I think there's some other bills that are actually going ahead in the same way, so perhaps the speaker will be short-circuited. It's not consent decree. That always pops into my head when I'm trying to think about the discharge petition. It finally came to me. So Ryan Cooper, also an editor at American Prospect, we're long on American Prospect today, talked about the irony of, among some other things, about the irony that by going after his enemies on the Epstein files, those papers will probably not be able to be released, so we'll be able to focus on other things, like including the dialogue, long-term dialogue that Chomsky had with Epstein, which I'm very curious about. I'd heard that he had used Epstein as a to get an introduction to some labor politicians in Israel, and that was sort of the extent of it. But apparently they had a long email exchange, went over for some years. So I'm curious what the heck they were talking about. All right, here's a rough cut, rough edit.
What was happening, almost certainly. I think that's a fair, conclusion for a reasonable person to draw. It's not proved, in black and white, but, I'm just curious to see if he is, fine with everything he's known publicly. What else could he possibly be hiding?
You've been describing as something akin to political malpractice, Democrats' restraint about discussing these materials, and I guess until Ro Khanna started championing their release. The Biden Attorney General Merrick Garland would have been in possession of all the emails and other materials that have been making headlines over the course of the past week.
Yeah, almost certainly. He committed suicide in 2019, right? And so you would have to think that the FBI could have gotten their hands on all of his emails, all of his, private correspondence in paper form, all of his personal possessions, as well as those of all of his, co-conspirators, above all, Ghislaine Maxwell. And, people could argue that these things were probably under seal because, basically the Supreme Court let Maxwell exhaust her appeals until after the election so that they could be kept under seal. But there's a lot of ways you could have tried to do an end run around that. And frankly, at the end of the day, just breaking the rules this one time and just, dropping it, whoops, on the, front steps of the Miami Herald or something like that, I think would not have, been, in the grand scheme of thing, an immoral action. I'm thinking of, President Lincoln's response to Chief Justice Roger Taney's attempt to, do a writ of habeas corpus on some guy who was doing treason for the Confederacy. And he said, are all the laws but one to go unexecuted and this the government itself go to pieces? I think it smacks of just the classic Democratic Party stuffy regard for their own self-image, that we're the fair ones. We are the responsible ones. We behave morally and we treat our opponents with kid gloves. And it just, at the end of the day, especially with Donald Trump, cashes out and he gets, the type of blank check to do things that no other defendant ever would have gotten. If you're a poor black kid who's accused of, robbing a convenience store, you just get thrown in pretrial detention and the book thrown at you. But if you're Donald Trump, then, you get to just straight up refuse multiple FBI requests to turn over the documents you stole from the National Archives and essentially has to force them into doing a raid on his estate at Mar-a-Lago. I mean, it's ridiculous. People, the priority should be exactly the opposite direction. Very high profile, you know, white collar criminals should get less deference from the legal system than poor ones. And it's outrageous.
All right. Thanks for indulging our tangent, Ryan Cooper. We invited you on to talk about something that happened in the world of tech earlier this month. At a conference, Sarah Friar, who is the chief financial officer for OpenAI, the AI darling of the tech world, reportedly made comments that suggested her company might need government support in the form of loan guarantees to keep burning money at the rate it is developing new artificial intelligence technologies. This is something you described as a pre-bailout. Those are comments she has since walked back, but the fact that she felt inclined to make them in that kind of company suggests this is something on the mind of people in this sector, thinking about where their next check is coming from and looking to the government, specifically the Trump administration. Why don't you walk us through the situation? Why would a company like OpenAI, that is the darling of investors and lenders, be looking for government help in the first place?
Yeah, we should mention that Sam Altman also made similar comments on a podcast with Tyler Cowen, The Economist, if I'm not mistaken. And he was basically saying similar things that, you know, if certain companies get too big, then the government eventually steps in as the insurer of last resort. And the problem with OpenAI specifically is that, you know, we have all of these AI models, large language models, image models, video models, you know, Sora, that OpenAI just came out. And they are all incredibly resource intensive to run. And so all of these AI systems that are being built are, you know, losing tons of money, especially OpenAI. You know, we're talking about, at least according to the numbers I've seen, sort of people trying to do back of the envelope arithmetic, you know, on the order of $10+ billion a quarter in losses at the current rate. And so, you know, the whole 40-odd% of, you know, GDP growth over the last quarter or two is AI capital expenditures, investment in AI stuff, data centers, and, you know, all the rest of the associated technologies that you need. And they're so expensive. You know, one company, Bain and Company, for folks who might remember the 2012 election, Mitt Romney's old stomping grounds, they estimated that these companies are going to need to be making, you know, on the order of $2 trillion by 2030 for all of these investments to pay off. And, you know, the wrinkle there is that, so OpenAI is being funded with tons of investment from outside venture capital and so on. But a lot of the rest of the AI build out is being funded out of profits from, you know, the big tech companies, you know, your Google, your Meta, and your Microsoft. And so the chance of a systemic, you know, crisis happening because, you know, companies took hundreds of billions of dollars in profits and set them on fire, that's not really that big of a deal for the rest of the economy. Facebook just did that with the metaverse, changed the company name to Meta. And, you know, it just turned out to be a big flop. OpenAI, however, you know, sort of the keystone of this whole ecosystem of, you know, NVIDIA and all the other tech companies. And, you know, it's starting to look like the people are starting to come to grips with the fact that there's not really any chance of there being the sort of huge consumer demand or industrial demand for these things that would justify that level of investment. And you see things like NVIDIA investing tons of money in OpenAI, and just this morning investing a bunch of money in Anthropic, you know, one of the other AI companies. And, you know, it starts to look very much like the snake eating its own tail. You know, like people are spending all this money on NVIDIA buying their graphics cards, and then NVIDIA goes around and invests in the same AI companies, you know, just to sort of like keep the money going around in a circle. It's like at some point there has to be another customer, you know, other than the guy selling the, you know, picks and shovels. And
which I haven't looked up this morning, Steele, but prior deals with NVIDIA, it wasn't actually a cash investment. They were just giving chips to these companies and getting stuff
right.
returned. It's like the cutting edge of high tech is operating on the barter system.
Yeah, exactly. And so I think the worry, or perhaps the hope from someone like OpenAI, is that you make yourself systemically important. That if so much of the whole economy depends on these companies not, you know, cratering, then hope, you know, the Trump administration will run, you know, print up a whole bunch of money and give it to them, you know, to keep them from going bankrupt, as more or less, you know, we saw with Wall Street in 2008. And, you know, a lot of this stuff is being funded by debt, you know, now with the financial sector getting involved in a pretty significant way just in the last few months. And that's how you could really see it come to infect the rest of the economy in a serious way, just like in 2008, where you'd have a general financial crisis. And that would, you know, just greatly constrict access to credit. You could imagine any number of ways that a sort of panic could get going. You know, just like in 2008, there's sure to be all kinds of crazy financial bets going on under the hood, really complicated derivatives contracts and stuff that nobody understands. You know, people write books about it after the fact. I'm sure there are a few people who have a really good, you know, a lead on it, Matt Levine, perhaps at Bloomberg. But, you know, I think that's sort of what they're hoping for, because they're looking at what it's going to take and the level of, you know, customer acquisition that they're getting. And it's very impressive, but it's not what it would require to make the numbers pan out.
So the burn rate of $40 billion a year, who's currently covering that? Like, what do we know about OpenAI's financial structure aside from the barter chips from NVIDIA?
Well, it's a private company still, but from what I understand, you know, and I'm not a great expert here, it's, you know, just venture capitalists. You know, it's a very similar dynamic we saw from the end of, you know, the financial crisis and even going back before that. There are just a lot of people with a ton of money and nowhere to put it. You know, the American economy has become so unequal over the years, especially wealth inequality, that the working class doesn't have the money that would justify like a straightforward business investment, you know, opportunity where you like, you know, start up a jeans company or something and you sell to a mass market, mass production, mass consumption, your classic capitalist business, that sort of thing. You know, most people are pretty tapped out, you know, and those sorts of opportunities are not very available. And so what we've seen over the last, you know, 15, 20 years, and especially is you have a lot of sort of vaporware. You have companies who get market share by explicitly losing money, like Uber. You know, the only way you can get a mass market is if you sell your product for less than it costs to produce it. You know, for going on 10 plus years, Uber was losing like 40 cents on the dollar for every ride that people took. And that was a sort of story that it would give you a story, a growth story that you could take to investors and, you know, get these massive investments. And a lot of times it doesn't pan out. But you know, you have a lot of people in Silicon Valley and elsewhere, and they got hundreds of billions of dollars and nowhere in particular to put it that would give them a decent return. And so, you know, you just sort of structurally, the economy tends to create these sort of flim-flam stories where like, oh, this is the next big thing. This one's going to pay off 15% for sure. And you got to get in on it because if you don't, somebody else is going to beat you to the punch. And, you know, that was NFTs, that was cryptocurrency, that was the metaverse, and, you know, all these other money-losing companies. It got, you know, Theranos, another great example.
That's Ryan Cooper. He is a senior editor of the American Prospect, and here's a book title for you. It's his book, How Are You Going to Pay for That? Smart Answers to the Dumbest Question in Politics. I like that. He mentioned that he is not as cognizant of all the economics. Well, Dave Dayan, who was also at the American Prospect, spoke with the same producer, Brian Edward Steekert, at some length about the AI bubble, et cetera. So I warned you I was going to get nerdy. Got some Joel Beinan, I think, for tomorrow, and probably some related stuff on Israel-Palestine. Like I mentioned, Gaza is off the headlines, despite the fact that the ceasefire has been broken multiple times, et cetera. In fact, the ceasefire and supposed ceasefire in Lebanon has been casually abrogated all of the time. Anyway, here's Brian Edwards Tickert with Dave Dayan, also of the American Prospect. Great analysis from him.
And that takes us just past 7:35 in the morning. The show is up front. My name is Brian Edwards Tickert. The state of the American economy is kind of wild right now. The Trump administration has taken all of these measures, like imposing tariffs, slashing away at the federal bureaucracy, disrupting the flows of aid that prop up the poorer sectors of our society, that in most conventional economic models would be expected to cause chaos and perhaps a recessionary spiral. And yet, according to the metrics we get from the official sources, our economy is still growing. The stock market is still at or near all-time highs. Donald Trump is still tooting his horn on the economy. But that economic success looks increasingly fragile when you look closer. The increases in stock market valuations have largely been driven by a handful of firms that have been major players in the artificial intelligence industry. And under the hood of the economic growth, an increasing share in the last readout, about 40% of increase in gross domestic product, was because of investment by AI firms in the construction of data centers. Buildings with massive amounts of electricity and cooling capability to host the very expensive graphic processing units that train the models that power the artificial intelligence services that the titans of capital are betting on. Any kind of economy that is not particularly diversified is an increasingly fragile one. So the pertinent question becomes, is all this spending that is propping up the economy a solid investment in future productivity, or does it have more of the markings of a bubble? Our next guest has been looking into the financing deals that are increasingly being used to stand up those data centers and is using the bubble word more and more often. David Dayan is executive editor of the American Prospect and author most recently of the book Monopolized. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
What is a special purpose vehicle?
That's a $1 million question. We first heard about these during the financial crisis. They were used to help the travel of mortgage-backed securities. And today, they are used to kind of mask some of the debt that is being taken on by these big tech firms. Big tech traditionally has not used a lot of debt to finance its operations, has a lot of cash flow. If it didn't have cash flow from revenues, it would get it from venture capital. And they kind of want to protect their heavy credit rating, their very good credit rating, rather than use hundreds of billions of dollars, which is scheduled for this build out of data centers. So what they do is a special purpose vehicle is created with the help of a private credit firm, which is kind of like a bank, but really it's more like a shadow bank, another term from the financial crisis days. And they create this special purpose vehicle, and the big tech firms who are renting out these data center facilities promise to make certain payments to cover the cost of the debt payments that are created by this special purpose vehicle. So even though the big tech firm is kind of taking on the debt, it doesn't look like that to the investors. They just think that they're investing in some other vehicle that gets a decent credit rating because they have this guarantee from the big tech firm. So it's a way for big tech to sort of take on debt without showing it to the markets.
So it's a separate corporate entity when you stand up a special purpose vehicle?
Yes, essentially, yes.
And so just to make sure I have the concept clear, if I'm, say, Meta, and I need a data center to help run an AI service,
right,
if I were to borrow money to set it up, my balance sheets would reflect that debt. But right, if I were to stand up a special purpose vehicle as a separate entity and put money and promises of money into it, I show what on my balance sheet? An investment? A positive?
You don't show any debt, which means you can maintain your credit rating, and you... it's simply an accounts receivable. You're just paying money really as a tenant to someone who is renting space in the data center, and you pay that into the special purpose vehicle. The owner of the SPV usually is not the big tech firm. It's this private credit firm, this outside bank that is using money from its investors to put a little bit of equity into the SPV. And then taking on, selling bonds essentially to take on debt to build out the rest of it.
What's a private credit firm? How is it different from a bank?
Well, it doesn't have any of the regulatory constraints of a bank. I mean, that's really the big thing. What that means is that it's just not seen in the same way. It doesn't have examiners that are constantly poring over its balance sheet. And so you get strange situations that pop up. The one that I used in the piece is a company called Blue Owl, which there is a very big data center project in Louisiana called Hyperion that Meta is the main tenant, and it's about $30 billion. They only put up, I think, $3 billion, Blue Owl did, and the rest of it is debt financed. They have a massive amount of money. They're financing all these deals with data centers, but they don't have the same kind of restrictions that a bank would. And this sort of emblematic and very dodgy situation that happened recently is that, with private credit, similar to private equity, there are different funds. So some investors invested at one point in time and they're in fund one, and then other investors come in and let's say they're in fund two. Well, Blue Owl merged fund one and fund two in such a way that when it all shakes out, the investors from fund one get 20% less of their money in fund two. And obviously, if you're an investor and you're about to get a 20% haircut, you kind of don't like that. And so you maybe say, well, why aren't you giving my money back? And I'll just go invest it somewhere else. Well, what Blue Owl did is they said, no, you're not allowed to redeem your money. We're blocking all redemptions until this merger is complete. That is a huge red flag. If that was happening with a bank, it would be basically akin to ending a bank run by saying, no, you're not allowed to take your money out anymore. But this happened and it barely caused much of a ripple. But it's a sign of very bad things to come. If they are locking in investor money, why are they doing that if they have all of this money available to them, if they're making all of these deals? That raised real alarms to me.
I guess I don't fully understand the alarm, because the analogy my brain is drawing is to private equity, where investors in private equity firms would agree to have their funds locked up for a set period of time, 5 years or whatever, before the fund closes and pays off its investors with its profits. Private credit is supposed to be more liquid?
It's absolutely true that you can lock up for a period of time, but I don't think it is the case in private equity that investors are supposed to willingly take a 20% haircut because they're merging and mixing around the amount of the funds. If the fund is closing, you're allowed to get your money out, even if it's locked up for a period of time. And, in this case, they're just saying, no, your value is less now. You were at 100, you're at 80 now. That's really different than just saying, look, there's some risk here and we need your money for a little period of time. You're actually taking a forced haircut. That's different.
Who are the investors? Like, whose money are the private credit firms managing?
It's coming from a lot of different places. One thing that we're seeing is that even though these things kind of, you can conceptualize it in your head that they're replacing banks, a lot of banks have money in private credit, about $300 billion, according to Moody's. There are, you know, all other firms like asset management firms, BlackRock, even institutional investors, not only sort of the likes of private ones like PIMCO, but also pension funds. So all of the sort of big institutional money that has traditionally funded maybe equities, maybe, you know, different bank loans and things like that, they are involved in private credit. And that's why that actually raises more fear, because it means that all of these other parts of the financial system and even the real economy are implicated in this huge bet on data centers, which, you know, there are a lot of questions as to whether these bets in physical infrastructure will pay off. Maybe the AI that results will be a major productivity increase, or it will create a lot of value. But the data centers themselves are very short-term, very rapidly depreciating instruments. And it's unclear whether the massive amount of loans that are being made and the debt that is being created to build them out will actually pay off.
Well, explain why you think they're short duration assets, because they're physical assets, right? They're concrete and steel and cooling systems and sometimes power plants, in addition to all the graphic processing units that operate within them. It is actually a thing in the material world of material value, presumably to someone, even if it's not running AI training operations.
It does seem like that. And that certainly has been something that has been used to justify the investment. Hey, we're building infrastructure here. But it actually is a little more akin to real estate than infrastructure. As I said, you know, you have a bunch of tenants in this data center. And the tenants really, you know, they're the firms, but they're also these GPUs. So these graphic processing units. And those are very short duration, especially if you're doing the kind of hard work that it takes to train an AI model. You know, a normal data center that's just sort of processing, you know, bits on the internet or something can last 6 years, 7 years, 8 years. The GPUs, when they're being driven this hard, may last only about 2 years, even though they are the duration that the companies who buy them are booking on their books is much, much higher. If they need to constantly be replaced, that's the real value. The steel and you know, the build out in terms of server farms and all of that is one thing, but the real value here is the GPUs, right? And if you can't keep up with having to constantly replace these things, then the data center itself just kind of becomes this massive hulk that doesn't have a whole lot of value to it. And so that's really the problem here, is that are we going to get the return on the investment to justify this constant churning and replacing of these GPUs, especially because the biggest firms are going to want to use the newest processors and literally replace these on an annual or maybe even quicker than that basis.
Do we know if they run out of like usefulness in 2 years, the chips from NVIDIA, the GPUs, do we know what kind of schedule they're being depreciated on the books of the companies that own them?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the very concerning things, is because that depreciation schedule has increased even as we get more and more information that the life cycle of the GPU is decreasing. So an OpenAI or an Oracle might say, oh, well, if we buy this chip, it's going to be valuable to us for 6 years. But then it's only valuable for 2 years. So then there's this unforeseen expense, at least from the context of their books, that, oh, we got to buy a lot more GPUs. And where's that money going to come from? And is this investment going to pay off? One of the really disturbing things that I found when going over this is that some of the smaller companies like CoreWeave, Lambda, that have a lot of debt, that are really just, they're almost like, they're the middlemen in this whole process. They just build data centers on spec, and then they find some tenants for it. These companies are using their loans that were backed by GPUs to purchase more GPUs. You can see this is just sort of an endless race that they can never catch up to. And it's those companies, if they sort of blow up in the middle of this, that will disrupt the ability to have this ecosystem continue.
So who gets left holding the bag? Like if, say, Google says, you know what, our bet on really inaccurate AI summaries in search results doesn't look like it's going to pan out. We're going to stop spending money on that and focus on putting intrusive ads in people's search column. Who gets left holding the bag when Google's money dries up?
Well, in fact, Google CEO Sundar Pichai just this week was kind of asked that question in so many words. And his answer was that no company is going to be immune if
it's a miracle
bubble bursts.
Oh, no company's going to be immune. I'm sorry.
No company is going to be immune if this bursts in the way that you're talking about. If we find that either the revenue isn't there, like you said, like people aren't actually buying AI, whether it's for their business or for personal use, that we're not making the kinds of numbers that justify this investment, or if competitor AI models like those found in China, which are much cheaper to produce, outflank the U.S. product, which is currently the market leader, I would say. There are a lot of ways that this could break. And really all you're talking about breaking is sort of the spirits of the market. It's the market that's saying, yes, we need more of this. We're willing to make this big bet. And, you know, NVIDIA's earnings this week showed that there still is a lot of appetite for that. And that kind of cooled what had been growing talk on Wall Street about an AI bubble. But of course, you know, the fact that there are more GPUs being bought, that NVIDIA is seeing these record sales is in many ways kind of what you would need for a bubble to grow, right? I mean, you need a sort of mania or fever over this and more GPUs being bought and financed for the conditions of, you know, what could be a terrible collapse to take root. And so, you know, that didn't really allay my fears that NVIDIA has record sales. So, you know, to answer your question, I think you will see it throughout the economy. But what is interesting is the role of banks here, because, you know, what we saw in 2008 is that the government had a lot of capacity to bail out those companies that were in trouble, and particularly financial companies. And so if this mountain of debt kind of moves into the balance sheets of banks, there is a time-worn way to extinguish that through the Federal Reserve and discount window and all of these various tactics. So what you may see is, while ordinary people would suffer from any kind of recession that would result from an AI bubble popping, the holders of the debt, if that ends up becoming banks, it would be a lot easier for the government to deal with that than if it was in the hands of these private credit companies.
The analogy you and I live with in our heads, because we lived through it, is the 2008 financial crisis. But in part, since this is being driven by a new technology, it sounds a lot more like the 1928 stock market bubble, where the run-ups in the market kind of started with bets on promising new technologies like radio and electricity, which were in fact promising and transformative new technologies, but not in a way that justified the valuations of the companies the stock market sent soaring.
Yeah. I mean, I think the crazy thing is that you can almost analogize every bubble inside this one, whether you're talking about tulip mania in Europe in prior centuries, or whether you're talking about the 1920s and private unregulated lending, whether you're talking about the build out of the railroads, which inspired multiple crashes that were almost at the scope of a depression level event, or whether you're talking about the build out of the internet in the 1990s, late 1990s, and the dot-com bubble that ended up crashing, didn't have as major a significance necessarily across the economy, but was a significant event in terms of the stock market. Right now, what we're seeing is stock market moves. AI companies are responsible for something like 70 to 80% of the change in the level of stocks right now. So, and then you layer on the sort of real estate slash securitization dodgy lending that we saw during the housing bubble. And it's kind of all rolled into one here. That's what really kind of spooks me.
All right. David Dan, we'll leave it there. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
David Dan is executive editor of The American Prospect. His most recent book, Monopolized: Life in the Age of Corporate Power. That does it for today.
Up front with Brian Edwards Tiekert, we also heard Ryan Cooper of American Prospect. Earlier, the piece from Marjorie Cohn on the anti-Semitism bill in California was from Law and Disorder Radio. That was at the top. Thanks for listening. WEFT, Champaign-Urbana listener-sponsored. Why are the opinions are you here are those of the speakers? Looks like I might be right on time. The Radio Free Labor cutting loose shortly.
This hour of programming is brought to you by the listeners of WEFT and Make It Champaign-Urbana. Make It Champaign-Urbana provides programs to assist new residents in getting connected to the community through the Champaign Welcome Crew. Are you passionate about the community? As an ambassador, you can help make a difference to new residents by answering their questions and sharing your community experiences. Ready to join over 50 ambassadors making a difference? For more information, visit makeitcu.com.